Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, this week we're going to talk about the news that's in the headlines. Of course, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And in particular, looking at the aspects of war crime. Now, whilst neither of us are experts in war crime at all, we have got, of course, considerable experience in investigating non-recent historic crimes. But let's just set the context. A recent attack on a maternity and children's ward, described by the president of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky, as a war crime. Three people killed, including a child, and 17 left injured. So what is a war crime? Well, in simple terms, it focuses on civilians, whether directly or indirectly through their infrastructure, who cannot be attacked. It also sets out the rules in relation to prisoners of war. So those are military personnel who are caught. And there are certain weapons that are prohibited. Under investigation at the moment, the Russians' use of cluster bombs. Now, cluster bombs themselves are bomblets that get released in the air from a missile. And the problem is that whilst they can't be targeted on a property or on a location, they also, when they hit the ground, don't all detonate. There's 100 countries signed up to it. Russia and Ukraine both are not signed up to that treaty. Nazir, you've seen the headlines. I mean, it does appear from it that there is indiscriminate bombing.
Yes, absolutely. Civilians being targeted, cities that clearly don't have any military purpose have been attacked, buildings with no military purpose have been attacked. Again, we're in the age of social media and we're in the age of video and TV. And let's do a shout out to all our media colleagues who are in the war zone, so to speak, because they Absolutely. Are putting their own lives at risk just simply to be able to inform us. And they are extraordinarily heroic in what they're doing. But evidently, there are ample examples, aren't there, Mark, where you could see this is not a battle between soldiers on a battlefield. This is one where women, children, citizens generally are being attacked.
President Zelensky has really been leading from the front in this. He's a comedian turned a politician. This is a man who has united countries, nations together to respond to Russia's action. I mean, quite an incredible man, isn't he?
I don't know where he came from. I mean, he's been president for a few years, but as you say, his background is comedy and even dance. I think he won the Ukrainian version of Strictly Come Dancing. But he's been extremely clever, has he not, in terms of using the media and social media in particular. There was one I remember very vividly was people were saying he's not actually in Kiev. He's not in his office. He's probably hiding somewhere in Poland or something. And he filmed himself on his phone, talking to the phone, and then the phone followed him into his office, and then the camera showed him on the phone in the office. You know, he responds in real time to people suggesting that somehow he's making this all up, and he has, as you say. I mean, can you think of a war which has had pretty much the whole world come against the invading army? I can't think of one.
No, it is incredible. I mean, he's garnished this response because he's a very natural person and he stayed in the country. And what we obviously know is that the Russians are doing everything possible to try and assassinate him, to get rid
of
him.
Yeah, they're sending teams in to do that, aren't they?
Absolutely. And he's been very well looked after by his team, I'm sure, going to various different locations around the country to keep safe. And we all pray and hope that continues, because I think his leadership right from the very front, out on the battlefields, as it were, to a degree, is inspirational.
Absolutely. He has been the face of the war, as far as the Ukraine is concerned. He's humanized it for us. It's not too countries that we don't know much about. He has been very, very open about the fact that he talks about his family. When he was elected president, he told his citizens, "I do not want a picture of me in your houses. I want you to put a picture of your own family up." He's been really, really clever in making sure that people realize it's human beings first and foremost.
And what do you think of his almost Churchillian statement that he gave to a absolutely packed house this week, in fact. And I remember I watched it on the news, and Mary Nightingale from ITV covered it, and she had tears in her eyes.
Absolutely. I mean, you may say almost Churchillian. It was Churchillian, but he changed the word slightly. I mean, it wasn't fight them on the beaches. It was fight them in the fields. You know, he knew his audience. He knew exactly what his audience would want to hear. If he hadn't done that, I'm pretty sure that he wouldn't have got the reception he does. As I said, he's been an extremely good communicator in extraordinary circumstances. And, I don't think there's any real... there's nobody else to look at in terms of how the world has come together. It's been his leadership of Ukraine at this terrible time that has brought the world community together against Russia.
Absolutely. I want to look a little bit in terms of the trials and war crimes. So let's just set the scene. There obviously has been a number of previous war crime trials, the war in Yugoslavia, the Rwanda genocide, where Hutu extremists killed 800,000 people in just 100 days.
Yeah.
And we've got so there's two courts set up. There's the International Court of Justice that rules on disputes between states, doesn't prosecute. So when they look at it, if they decide that Russia has committed a war crime, that gets passed back to the UN Security Council to enforce that judgment. And then you've got the Prosecution Court, which is the International Criminal Court, and they prosecute individuals for war crimes. The current chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, QC, has said that there is a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes have been carried out in Ukraine. But there's a major problem here, and this is where the criminal justice system only is effective if it has teeth, and the teeth work, is that court does not have its own arresting force. So even if the International Criminal Court decide that, yes, there is a case to answer, which Karim Khan has said there is, they then have to go and arrest those individuals for the offences.
Yeah.
Russia is not signed up to that treaty. There's no one physically, as far as a police force on behalf of the International Criminal Court, can go and arrest somebody. And therefore, that would mean that somebody has to go into Russia to arrest the individuals. But then it gets even worse. Because Russia is not signed up to the International Criminal Court Treaty, there is no jurisdiction.
I think you've outlined the difficulties quite well there. let's go back to basics. There are four war crimes. There's crimes against aggression, which is, you know, invading a country. That cannot be prosecuted in this case because Russia are not a signatory, as you say, to the ICC. There are crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes more generally, including rape being used as a weapon of war, which is a more recent addition. The ICC is a permanent court, and a couple of things to be said about that, and this is where we should take some pride in this. Kamal Khan, QC, the chief prosecutor, is British. And so, you know, the chief prosecutor is British.
Do you know him? Do you know
him? I do. Yeah. I'm going to go even further. The registrar of the criminal court, i.e. the man who is responsible for the administration of the court, is also British. Peter Lewis was the chief crown prosecutor for Nottinghamshire before he became the chief executive of the Crown Prosecution Service. So the two most important figures in the ICC are both British lawyers. And that, I think, is a testament, really, to the quality, I was going to say British lawyers generally, but certainly of those two individuals. Now, absolutely. The problem we've had in the past with war crimes is, never mind the evidential, we'll come on to in a moment, is the political element of it. Until recently, until the Yugoslavian leaders were convicted a couple of years ago, the only people that had ever been convicted were black people from Africa. And it looked a little bit like, well, not a little bit, a lot like the white Western world prosecuting black people from Africa. It's, as I say, that's changed now with the conviction of the leaders of the former Yugoslavia. But the legal obstacles can be overcome, and I think the reality is that Ukraine, for example, even though Russia and Ukraine have not signed up to the treaty that set up the ICC, both Ukraine publicly and officially allowed the ICC jurisdiction, in effect. So that can be looked at. And the other thing that you just touched on is that nobody can be prosecuted in absentia. You can't be prosecuted without being before the court. So if Putin or any of his commanders, whatever it is, eventually do get prosecuted, they have to be in The Hague. You can't do it by video. You can't do
and
it.
And that is a major problem because you...
It has been.
For Russia, you'd have to get in there, get those people and take them to The Hague. And the chances of getting into Russia is pretty hard.
Yeah, but this is where, this is the other side of politics, is that people's, today's superstars are tomorrow's, So I wonder, in a little while, if this matter goes very badly for Russia, whether Putin will remain in power and whether or not the other leaders in Russia will give him up, which is obviously what happened in other countries when Charlie Taylor in Liberia, for example, he was a dictator, but the moment he was over, overtaken in effect, quick to send him to The Hague. So the politics might work against Putin in time. But as I say, these are very difficult cases and they take a long, long time. I mean, the Yugoslavia wars were in the mid-90s and it's taken 25 years for the conviction of
leaders.
And
I think that's a really significant point, isn't it? Because whilst we look at war crimes and we think, these should be prosecuted now, often we have to wait for the time to change and environments and circumstances to change, which is why very often there's many, many decades pass before these leaders are eventually brought to trial.
Yes, absolutely. The court is notoriously slow. But that, you have to think, firstly, I mean, this conflict or this war invasion has to finish. Then there's the political repercussions, which may take several years. Mm-hmm. Then, and the evidence gathering, which has already started, but that has to be undertaken. And then, of course, you have a trial, which has to be fair and open, and in some cases takes several years. So if we could speed it up in some way, I think it would have much more confidence and people would have more credit, more confidence in it. But I think people need to be awake, really, to the fact that if there is ever going to be a prosecution in the ICC for what's happening in Ukraine, it will probably be in 10 or 15 years' time.
And it's quite hard to, I was reading quite a bit around this, in terms of bringing Putin himself to trial. You've got the onus is very much on individuals. And so you'll get the generals and the leaders of the army and those things. But to actually bring the leader themselves is often quite a bit harder.
It is. But as I said a moment ago, sometimes this is where the politics works. The rest of the world will say to Russia, in order for you to move on, in order for you to get back into doing business with us and reopening all your bank accounts and everything else, as part of that arrangement, you have to provide us with access to certain individuals who we would want to try in The Hague. So you can see that the winners of conflicts tend to be the people who are in the driving seat when it comes to being able to prosecute somebody. It's rare for the losers to have that ability to do so. So, one hopes and one imagines that at some point this war will finish and that the Russians will want to try and restore their place at the seat of the world, in effect. And the way to do that, I imagine, will be, in order for you to get your money back, in order for you to get your football clubs back, or whatever it is that assets they own, you will also, as part of that, you need to give up these people.
Yeah, there's no love lost in politics, is there? Stab in the back. Once you're out the back door, it doesn't take long for someone to stab
history.
You in the back.
If you're history, as you say, the politics will enable people to receive justice, who currently, right now, seem to be able to act with impunity.
And yesterday's news, it was big headlines yesterday, this restrictions imposed on Chelsea Football Club by the government in relation to the selling of tickets for non-debenture holders and also for items in the shop and, of course, the payment of players and transfer. This is big. I mean, we're talking about the war in Ukraine and what we can't forget when we talk about all the other issues that surround it is the tragedy of the hundreds, thousands of individuals, civilians and military personnel who are losing their life as a result of this. But the impact around the rest of the world is daily being felt.
I can't imagine that a Chelsea football fan thought that the invasion of Ukraine would have an impact on their ability to buy and sell players. Or in fact, even get a ticket to the match, because that's what sanctioning Abramovich has done. The asset is now perceived to be frozen, whilst an investigation takes place as to how it was obtained. So you can't sell your players, you can't make new contracts, you can't end contracts, you can't simply send somebody away on a free transfer because they're an asset of this allegedly stolen, corruptly obtained asset. And so people like Lukaku, for example, who clearly wants out, he's now stuck. They can't simply let him go because that's £85 million worth of Abramovich money that the government wants to has frozen and wants to hold on to. The ramifications of what's happened, have gone way beyond what I imagined. And I think the fact the world community has come together. Banks have been closed, and Starbucks and McDonald's have closed their Moscow branches. The world has looked at what's happened and said, right, we're going to punish you. We're going to punish you so that you firstly realize that what you've done is wrong, and secondly, that you stop doing it. And yeah. I think this is unprecedented in my lifetime. I've not known such a cohesive, coherent response. And also a hell of a lot of hypocrisy, Mark. Until recently, we were happy to allow Russian oligarch money to steam into our country and into our banks and buy our assets. You go into central London, think about the number of houses owned by Russian oligarchs. And within a blink of an eye, we're now saying, we don't like you. We don't want you.
It's a really difficult one, isn't it? Because, you keep your friends close and your enemies even closer. And I think there's a point to which, where does it all change? And you're absolutely right. For many, many years, we've entertained the Russians. We've allowed Putin to slowly build his extremist views, his views of total totalitarianism. Yet we, on the other hand, now have gone full circle and said, oh, no, we're not happy with that. Well, we're not happy with that, but we've allowed you and we've fed you and we've given you your corn every single day. And now we're going to turn around and say no, when actually, could we have done more in the build-up to this by actually slowly chipping away and not allowing Russia to be as powerful and controlling as they are?
Yeah, of course we could have. I mean, the bulk of the oligarchs got their extraordinary wealth in 1991. Immediately the Soviet Union collapsed. They moved from whatever role they had into suddenly owning the gas companies and the coal companies and everything else. And then, of course, they quickly moved their money offshore or into the United Kingdom. We've got a lot to answer for, because I think even the Americans said, and there was an FBI report that said, the bulk of Russian money, hidden assets, were in the UK or in City of London or in tax havens that are British. So we've allowed that. We've lived off it. Fees have come from that. Salaries have been paid. The reality is that money is Russian citizen money, not oligarch money, and has been taken from them and fed these extraordinary lifestyles that that we've seen over the years. Which I went to this dinner just before COVID, a very big charity dinner in central London, which was attended by several ministers, and firstly I felt really totally out of my depth, but nonetheless, whilst I'm sitting there, I'm seeing these Russian oligarchs walking around this charity dinner as if they were royalty. They literally, tables would stand up for them in a way that Her Majesty the Queen might get, but nobody else would. And they were embedded in British high society, and it was money. At the end of the day, it was their money that was buying off people. People were deferring to them in the way that they were doing simply because they had access to funds and they were investing it in property or whatever it may be. We have to take a good look at ourselves, actually, as to why it is that we allowed this to happen, and whether we'll allow it to happen again in the future. When you think about other countries with significantly poor human rights records that we've allowed into our country to purchase football clubs or whatever else.
We're very poor at retrospectively looking at ourselves in terms of current position. So those that have the power now to foresee the future, are they prepared to look at that and go, actually, do you know what? We could tackle some of these things now. But unfortunately, politics is today, isn't it?
It's due diligence. You were expected, you and I are expected, if we were paid some money by some company for doing some work for them, we would be expected to check everything about them to make sure that every penny that we received was above board, there was a proper audit trail, et cetera, et cetera. However, our leaders and the extraordinarily large corporates have just simply said, oh, thank you, £10 billion, that's very kind of you. Yeah. And never asked a question. It goes back to what we've said before, actually, Mark, about one law for some and another for the rest of us. You can bet your bottom dollar HMRC would come down on us like a ton of proverbs.
Totally.
And so would the fraud squad or whatever else. But when it comes to these enormous sums, it's a total blind eye.
Yeah. No, the white collar crime at the very, very top is as good as ignored.
100%. And it happened after the financial crash in 2008, where the only people that were ever convicted were the really, really low level bankers. The major banks were just paid off with our money. Our taxpayers' money went to them. It happens every single time. We bail out the powerful and the rich, but the poor, if you were on disability allowance right now, and you decided, I don't know, to get a second job because your universal credit wasn't good enough, you can bet your bottom dollar they would throw the proverbial fridge at you. Is there such a thing as throwing a proverbial fridge at somebody? I don't know. I've never heard that phrase before. But anyway, let's think about a proverbial fridge. But if you've got multi billions and you have access to more multi billions, they just don't even look at it.
Yeah, it reminds me, totally changing the subject, fridges. Years ago when I was in the police, I did a public order training and we went into this building and we went to go and actually take a person out of the building. And as we went into the building, we walked up the stairs as a three-man team with our shields above our head. And this person threw a fridge on top of us.
Oh, God.
And I had a fridge on my head as I walked up the stairs. And you can imagine, it was a big enough fridge that the person could lift, but it was still incredibly heavy when it falls on your head, God. And you're not expecting it. So, but one of the things that moving forward that worries me, and I think we've got to be very aware, you know, that there is a big mental health impact of the war on people here. And I've said to quite a lot of people recently, just be really careful of how consumed you get by it. You might want to just watch the news once at night. I wouldn't advise keeping it on throughout the day.
And children and young people. I spoke to some parents last night, actually, and they were saying, I don't know how to talk to my children about what they're hearing and what they're seeing. You know, this may be the war where we actually begin to understand the sort of vicarious impact on the viewer. Yeah. Because I don't think we've got any guidance or any way of being able to say to ourselves, how do we can't look away, but we've got to be more circumspect about what it is that we see. And then, you know, the fact that it traumatizes people who may see it, obviously it's not as traumatic as those who are experiencing it. Let's be clear about that. But, you know, if you are a child and you're a parent of a child and your child sees blooded children on TV, you've got to have a conversation with them about that. You can't simply just say, let's watch EastEnders now. We've got to be able to talk about these things.
And I think it's really important. You know, we're both parents and both come from very much a background of safeguarding children. And it's all about age-appropriate conversation, but it's about making sure that you take the lead. So rather than listen to it from a media outlet, sit down with your child in an environment where you can say, so I just want to have a chat with you with regards to what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. Explain the very simplistic background to that, in that Russia wants to take over some parts of land of Ukraine and want to take some ownership of that, and that they've invaded it. And when, of course, an individual invades another country with today's warfare, that means that they bring guns with them and they shoot and kill people.
No, I, you're absolutely right. It has to be age appropriate. Teenagers know more than perhaps you and I do. And I think we need to talk about misinformation here, because this is quite an important thing. The world has changed, has it not? When I used to watch somebody reporting from a war zone, like Michael Burke from Ethiopia or something back in the early 80s, we listened, we set up Live Aid, we saved, now people will be thinking, was he really in Ethiopia? You know, yes. Was that, they call them crisis actors. It's, they were talking about the maternity ward and saying this woman that's got blood all over her and pregnant, she's just a crisis actor. And of course, the Russians don't help in this regard. A lot of the bots that exist are emanate from there. So they're very quick to pour scorn on what you and I would know to be true and consider to be true. And so people are now beginning to, there's an information war. We talked earlier on about Zelensky and the work he's fighting. There's a reason why he is doing that, because we're in a world where the information war is as real as the one involving bombs. And people need to get their news and get their information from trusted sources. But now we don't know who's trusted anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It does strike me as quite worrying that the people who were anti-vaccine and didn't believe in COVID now seem to be very supportive of Russia. You know, it's almost like, you know, and also what, the other thing that struck me actually, Mark, you and I, you said at the outset, we're not experts on war crimes, but you could bet your bottom dollar that there are people now who are experts on Russia and Ukraine who 2 months ago were experts on COVID and vaccine. Yeah. 9 months ago were experts on Brexit and European trade. What the world has come to, your 30 years of working in law and my 30 years mean nothing now. Somebody was spending 30 minutes on Reddit or YouTube suddenly makes them the world's expert.
Yeah, they come out of the woodwork, don't they? Suddenly, I'm an authority on this. I mean, and I think you're right, because people consume the news in different fashions now. You go back to, you know, when we were young, there was only the very simple BBC, ITV. Yeah. That's all that existed. And then, of course, Channel 4 came along, Channel 5 came along, Sky came along, and we've now got a multitude of different outlets as far as news goes. And in fact, the younger generation consume the news completely differently. You know, sitting down and watching the 6 or 10 o'clock news, you know, like perhaps you and I would do, and certainly our older generation would do. They don't. They consume it through YouTube. They consume it through social media, and therein lies the problem, because you could end up following someone who has an agenda or who has a view in a certain way, and doesn't provide you the impartiality.
I used to think there was little kids. The other day, I was my two youngest sons were here, and they were watching TV. Rarely, I think there was something on Channel 4, a movie, I can't remember what it was, which they thought they would watch because he was here from university. And they couldn't get over the fact they were adverts. You know, what the hell, what's this? Why are they having an advert? And I was thinking, what? Well, it's got to be paid for. They said, oh, but we can watch it on Netflix or streaming, and there's no adverts. And I was thinking, we're a completely different beast. And you're 100% right. There are people out there who think they're experts, who are quite malicious in what they do, and sending out material that is undoubtedly untrue, but is used for a purpose. There are others who are just simply lazy and short circuit information. But as I say, as we've said earlier on, it really is dangerous. And we started this conversation talking about the war crimes. Well, any crime that is being prosecuted will rely upon evidence. Now, you know, your experience of historical crime and mine as well shows how difficult it is to collect the evidence. Right now, what the Met Police, we always mention the Met Police pretty much every program, but they have the national lead for tackling war crimes.
Along with the national lead for so many other things as well.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And that we've said before, take them away, make the Met Police more manageable, give it to some other agency. But anyway, SO15 have already said, we're now collecting the evidence. And they've said, and Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, has said a message to everybody. If you see a text message, a WhatsApp message, a video, something social media, please archive it. Please send it to us, because we need, this is all evidence.
Yeah.
You know, if you saw, you know, individuals, you know, if you see a particular soldier doing something on TV or in a Facebook post or whatever it is, we need to have that. Now, I don't know where they're going to put all this stuff.
No, because imagine the poor person that starts to receive all of that. They send it to this email address.
Yeah, I know. They're completely drowned in it. But, you know, the point is, it has to be collected. It has at some point need to be analyzed and sifted. But, you know, basically, anybody listening to us today, the message is the same. You know, if you see something that you think might be of use to any future prosecution, please send it to the authorities. And But there is, you know, this is going back to our earlier point about how long these cases take. Just, you know, just in one day, I imagine there'll be tens of thousands of pieces of online virtual evidence that they have to collect.
But that does work. That does work to advantage. It's like, you know, policing now has changed so considerably in terms of evidence gathering. You know, the facts now, the I call them the external factors, you know, the CCTV, the social media, the communication that happens through phones. You know, that is now a massive element of any investigation. Gone are the days when you used to only have a communication between two people or perhaps even a letter written. Now the external factors are considerable, and that supports the collection of evidence, doesn't it?
100%. Satellite imagery. You know, now, you know, never mind Google Earth, obviously the national, international satellites can probably zooming in on you right now next to your computer. So, you know, that will undoubtedly be collected right now. They'll be collecting evidence of the behavior of individual commanders on the battlefield, individual soldiers on the battlefield. You know, and all of that has to be collected. It then has to be sifted. It then has to be analyzed to see whether or not any crimes have been committed by particular individuals. It then has to be presented in the right way. I'm glad I'm not working in the ICC, actually. Just talk myself out of the job there. I can't imagine how difficult and complicated that is, but it has to be done. This is the thing about people, you know, our children are crying out and saying somebody needs to be held to account for the fact that that child was attacked and murdered or killed. Absolutely. Or that hospital was attacked. And so for people to have faith, regain their faith in humanity, those who are responsible for these atrocities have to be brought to justice.
Absolutely. I was listening the other day to an article, the Russians were struggling with their communication in Ukraine. And what they had done is they bought some SIM cards and they were using Ukrainian SIM cards to communicate between the Russian leaders. And you just think to yourself, how on earth had you not given any preparation? So the listening services within Ukraine, of course, were well onto that. And as a result of that, they caught the communication between the Russians talking about their invasion and elements of it, of Ukraine, which is, so your technology now is a massive assist in terms of this whole process. But therein lies any problem. I mean, any major investigation always has a very careful balance in terms of how much media coverage it goes for. Because whenever you have a major crime, such as, you know, say, a murder of a high-profile person, one of the greatest fears in those early days and weeks of any of those investigations is the sheer number of pieces of information that come into an incident room. And you've got to sift through every single piece and make a determination as to how quick you respond to each of those.
Absolutely.
And I can't begin to imagine the sheer scale, given the amount of news outlets that are covering this story, to collate and collect all that information.
I think, again, using our experience, you know, if you had a predator who had abused 250 children, for example, you might, in terms of prosecuting the case, you might focus on half a dozen of those victims, because what you wanted to do is convict him and then be able to talk about the broader picture. I did that with the Rothschild case. There were 47 girl victims. We selected six who formed part of our case. So in terms of the war, what they might do, the invasion might do, is, for example, this attack on the maternity ward, rather than focus on everything around that, let's focus on who was responsible for this and this alone.
Be targeted.
Yeah, exactly. And then once you've chosen that particular incident, and that's the incident you will investigate and throw all your resources at it, undoubtedly you'll get the command chain. You'll be able to work out who in Putin's team was responsible, et cetera, et cetera. So that might be the way forward, rather than scattergun trying to look for evidence of every war crime. Focus on a select few and do those in great detail in order to be able to identify the people responsible.
And I think that's really important. I remember taking a guy to the Central Criminal Court, Anthony Bridger, who was an air traffic controller, and in his offending behaviour had been over 15 years. And when we charged him over 100 crimes because of the way the recording process worked then. And I remember the QC, lovely lady, she came out to me and said, he's prepared to accept a number of the charges, but only these ones. And I said, I'm prepared to accept the for him to admit to charges, not all of them, as long as I get the very first series of offences, I get the middle series of offences, and I get the end offence.
Yeah.
Because that way then I could show that over that period of the 15 years, his offences started, continued in the middle, and ended.
Absolutely. That's a very common occurrence. And it also means that the judge can sentence appropriately. So the judge is saying, I'm sentencing you for 15 years of abuse, and not for that month in 2012. You know, it's about showing the pattern of criminality and giving the court sufficient sentencing powers. Because otherwise, you'd still be trying Mr. Bridger. You know, that case would still be going on several years later. Yeah. There has to be a way of being able to get to the core of the matter without necessarily giving. But the other side of that, and this is something we all understand, is that the victims who are not before the court will be thinking, they have to properly explain this to them. They'll be thinking, well, I didn't get justice. And you've got to explain to them that, yes, you have, but we wanted to ensure that you didn't, that this case was resolved relatively quickly, also that we reduced the trauma on you all, and that we were able to deliver justice in an expeditious way. And I think communication, again, is quite key when as you did in your case, and I'm sure I've done in mine, to make sure people are aware, just because they're not on the indictment, just because the defendant is not charged with your crime, doesn't mean that he's not guilty of it.
No, absolutely. It's so important because for many victims of crime, it's about being heard, it's about being believed, it's about being listened to. And I mean, the irony of that case was that this was a Friday morning and he pleaded not guilty to everything. And then she came and said, look, there's a potential of a plea bargain here. And I said, well, I'm only prepared to accept that. She said, I'll go and we'll put it back to his lawyer to speak. He goes and has his fish and chip, as every prisoner does on a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. He comes back in the afternoon and pleads. And I always think about that as being the fish and chip moment. That's enough to make somebody change their decision from being not guilty to being guilty. And you just then think, well, you know, if it's as simple as that.
Do you know, you started me thinking as well in terms of this particular war crime, that there will be deals done. And people need to have to prepare themselves for this. Putin may not necessarily be brought to justice. Putin may give up some of his commanders. He may give up some of his advisors. This is the kind of thing that happens. You know, as I mentioned earlier on, in relation to financial crime, the person at the front desk is the one who gets convicted. The bank manager walks away free, and we've got to be ready for the fact that it may not mean that everybody responsible for these war crimes is brought to justice. But we just have to make sure that the right people are.
What worries me particularly now, so on a daily basis, we're seeing the impact of this war, not just in terms of through the lens of the media and the horrific nature of the murders that are taking place, but the real reality of increasing prices over the UK, food shortages, and particularly fuel. And I pose the question, and I don't have the answer, and I'm sure you don't have the answer, is how does this end? Putin is not going to suddenly walk away and go, okay, something has to happen that means that he stops.
Yeah. I mean, he has to, you know, he's lost face. He doesn't want to lose face. Some people say this is about his legacy. He wants to be remembered in the same breath as Lenin and Stalin. Well, you are, thank you. I'm not something you should be proud of. He wanted that legacy. There are other players in this. Don't forget China. China, you know, have abstained on pretty much everything as far as this invasion is concerned. But they are, you know, Russia has been building a strong alliance with China as the world looks east. So they have a role to play. We've got to the stage now where, Russia, you can't buy a coffee, you can't eat a pizza, you can't get McDonald's. The Russian citizen is being, I know they've been given lots of stories by the Russian media that suggest that this isn't happening. They will be able to see it on their own doorstep. So the Russian citizen may have something to say on the matter. The other leaders in Russia whilst Putin is extraordinarily strong, there may come a time when some of them think this has gone too far. So the politics, internal and external, I think maybe will be at some point the response. Of course, the worst case scenario is he drops a nuclear weapon on us. We have a war across the world, and we're not here to record our next podcast. But that's the reality. We don't know where it will end. We hope it's not the latter. We hope at some point somebody somewhere sees some sense, some pressure is applied, and we get to a situation where people aren't harmed in the way they're currently being harmed.
I just want to mention one thing, because I know that it's something that when I first heard it, I thought, I wonder why not. And this is the issue of closing airspace over Ukraine.
Yeah.
So what the Ukraine president, Zelensky, has said that the airspace should be closed. Now, the defense secretary and others have been very clear to explain why that isn't possible. And in simple terms, is if you close an airspace, you effectively have to police that.
You have to enforce it. And that will mean American or British or European fighter planes having dogfights with Russian and Belarusian aircraft. And the moment one of them goes down, some people think we're already in World War III, but then we would definitely be in World War III. I think that's part of the problem. The response of the, I think that's the right approach. We don't want to escalate it beyond where it is. But there are ways of being able to close down an airspace without closing down an airspace. I mean, you mentioned technology earlier on. Surely, there must be some technological way that prevents, I don't know the answer to this question, Mark. But, for example, there's this buzzing device that you put outside some shops so children can't congregate there because they get the sound impacts on children, but doesn't, by the way, they shouldn't be doing that. That's against the law. But anyway, they do it. Surely there's some kind of technological boom or something they can use that prevents the aircraft from flying over Ukraine. I don't know the answer to that question, but I would not want them to for our aircraft or aircraft from Europe or whatever it is to engage with Russian aircraft, because I think that the only way.
Well, at the moment, you have to police an airspace, and the moment Russian won't comply with it, so Russia will go into that airspace that's been closed, and a plane will be shot down, and then we have a real world war.
Yeah, we do. I don't want that. Your children don't want that. Nobody wants that. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
So, listen, we've talked about some pretty heavy stuff this week, and I think it's really important that we keep mindful about how difficult this is for people to listen to cover. And I would say, just give yourself space. We still have an incredible world we live in. Our country is great. We have some brilliant things. And I would encourage everybody to as positive as you possibly can be at this time.
And look out for your neighbours. You may be resilient and strong, but somebody around you, some child around you, may not necessarily have that same resilience. And as you mentioned earlier on, we're going through some dark times with the cost of living and fuel prices. So we just need to keep strong.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, as ever, Nazir, you're brilliant. Please do give us feedback. We read everything that you send in. And also, when we can, we look to filter your inquiries or certainly your topics into areas that we cover. We can't always cover it as a single topic, but we will end up feeding it into overall topics we do. So get in contact, drop us an email or contact us via our Twitter page. Until next week, look after yourself. Nazir, take care.
And you too. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.